Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Copa Libertadores Preview Pods. Yes, we're back. It's been a long time coming, but I'm delighted to say Copa Libertadores is back. I missed last night. Adam did a sterling job standing in for me. He's back again tonight. How are you, Adam?
Yeah, I'm good. It sounds like World War III outside my ass tonight, so apologies for any background noise during this pod. Yeah, well, the local drug dealer's out, so we're all running for cover.
Well, as long as it's only the local drug dealer, everything will be fine. Don't worry. You and I will testify to that. We're just off a week of carnival. We're the survivors. We have Ewan Marshall in Sao Paulo back again. How are you, Ewan?
Evening, guys. Yeah, not bad. Currently knee-deep in post-carnival depression and flu, but nothing I haven't seen before.
Yes, it was the reason, actually, I skipped last night was over-exuberance, actually, over the last week. So, but we have a really, truly South American feel this evening to our show. Everybody's in South America, and what's more, we have a bona fide Argentinian in the form of Nico Miramont. Nico, your first time in WFI. You are very, very welcome. How are you?
Very good, thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting me for my first incursion into the world of podcasting. It's really exciting. I'll be looking forward to hearing my voice in your recording afterwards.
Well, indeed, you won't have to wait too long to hear it. And maybe just for our listeners, you're based in Buenos Aires in Argentina. Who's your team down there? What do you do in the world of football, Nick?
Well, my team is not doing much at the moment. The reason being that our league is like detained. It hasn't resumed since the first half of the season due to political reasons. First of all, our association is in deep crisis after our glorious leader, Grondona, passed away a couple of months ago. And well, that led to a series of answers that got a lot of people into trouble, and especially got the teams into trouble. You might already know that Argentinian football has been state financed for like more than a decade. And of course, now that things have changed, the government is a completely new one. I wouldn't call it an overhaul, but it's different. So yeah, clubs are in crisis. And they are demanding a payment for 5-6 months. Some of the lower league players are looking for new jobs. Driving cabs or maybe even painting houses. So, yeah, my club is not doing anything at the moment because the league won't resume until those players get their payments.
Nico, just while we're on it, you know, Adam had touched on it on the previous pod as well around this. Is there any sign of a resolution, or how long do you think that this may continue?
Yes, of course there is. And like the answer spins around money. It's always about money. I mean, football is an industry, but the problem here is that no one wants to pay. And why is this? Well, first of all, the new government has set a new policy of, how can I call it, stepping away from the world of football. That means cancelling the existing contract for the broadcasting of the matches, which was paid by the state. So that contract was supposed to regard the world of football until 2019. And of course, we are like 2 years apart from that. There are new systems, new ideas coming out of thin air, which the government wants to, I don't know, put into practice, like the creation of a Super League, an independent entity which is supposed to run the first division. Most of all, separating the world of football from the state financing. So after Grondona passed away, many clubs were sinking in debt, and now without the aid of the state at every end of the season, they are into lots of trouble because they can't pay their debts. They must tighten their belts to an extreme end because they just can't pay their debts. They can't afford new contracts. And we don't have a TV deal either, so no one wants to broadcast our football. There are many proposals, but the association is now under a de facto government because there is no president. I should add that most recent election ended up in a draw. Yeah, that's right. Draw. I don't know. It's complete chaos. There is an end, and we must wait until Thursday, probably, which will be the moment when the payment will reach the AFA's bank account. And that way, the money will be distributed to the players. And that way, the players' union will resume their activity.
No, and that sounds like just total another chaos. And I'm sure Adam will have questions for you in around what impact you feel that will have with the Argentinian teams as we go along. But listen, I want to get down into the groups. And Adam and the guys left off last night on group four. So we'll go into group five here. And it's one that Ewan will prick his ears at. The one with Palmeiras, Peñarol, Jorge Wisterman, and Atletico are the great entertainers so far of the preliminary rounds. I'll come to you first, Ewan, because obviously Palmeiras, of all the Brazilian teams at the moment, I actually fancy them the most. They look in good shape. They bought Borja, who's already started scoring for you. You must be going into this with, you know, a bit of confidence, Ewan.
Yeah, well, first of all, these are the Brazilian champions, and since the end of last season, like, of course, they've lost two very important figures. One of them, obviously, being Gabriel Jesus, who is now at Manchester City, and of course, the manager Cuca, who has taken some time out of football for some personal reasons. And so, besides those two players, the rest of the squad is more or less the same in terms of they've held on to all of their other big talents. We've had plenty of offers from Europe. I mean, you have the Colombian centre-back Yeri Mina, who is arguably the best centre-back in the continent at the moment, and he'll be off to Barcelona next year. We've got a hold on him for now. Also, Vitor Hugo, his centre-back partner, is also staying. Dodô, who's on the fringe of the Brazilian national team, he's also staying. So they've managed to keep that spine together, and as you mentioned, they've strengthened in quite impressive fashion, actually. So Palmeiras have brought in two former Brazilian World Cup players, in Felipe Melo and Michel Bastos. Michel Bastos, it seems like he is probably going to be a reserve for now, but Felipe Melo is, you know, the first choice centre midfielder. I'm not 100% sure what I feel about that, but he certainly has plenty of experience. And besides those two, they've also brought in two of the best players of last year's Copa Libertadores from the last year's Libertadores winners, Atlético Nacional, in Alejandro Guerra, the Venezuelan midfielder, and of course, as you mentioned, Miguel Borja, who was voted as the best player in South America last year. And as you also mentioned, he's had two appearances off the bench and has already scored two goals. So it looks like he's going to be able to fit well into that system. So basically, if you're looking at that, I think on the whole, the squad has improved. You have the champions of the richest and highest quality league in the continent, and the squad has improved on that on the end of last year, in my opinion. The only thing I think that which could get in their way is that this kind of period of adaptation for their new coach Eduardo Batista I wouldn't say it's going badly, but it's just taking a little bit of time for him to kind of get his ideas and him to kind of adapt his own ideas to the squad. And there are, even when he was announced as being the new manager, there was a large portion of Palmeiras fans who were not happy with it at all. And so he's already facing quite a lot of criticism from the fans. Things do seem to be picking up a little bit. I mean, in the last two games, in the state championships, they've scored 7 goals in the last two games, winning 4-1 at home to Ferroviária last week in Carnival, and they won 3-1 last night on Friday night away to Red Bull. So it seems like things are just starting to come together, but they've got a difficult opener, in my opinion. They have to go away to play Atlético Tucumán in Argentina. Even though Palmeiras are clearly superior in terms of quality, it's a difficult place to go to.
A big crowd there, Ewan. We saw in the preliminaries, they have a very vocal crowd. It's a big atmosphere there. It'll be a test for you.
Yeah, that's it. And so you fear that if Palmeiras come away from that game with a result which is anything less than satisfactory, then the criticism behind Eduardo Baptista is only going to grow and grow, and they could end up shooting themselves in the foot, and you know that kind of could derail their bid. But I think, you know, there's absolutely no question about it. I think Palmeiras have to be the favourites for this Copa Libertadores because they have the best team and the best squad. It's just a matter of mentality and keeping things together with the manager, I think.
Yeah, they had a pretty strong team last year, but it seemed to me like they went into the Libertadores a little bit cold. You know, they had only played a couple of state league matches before their first couple of Libertadores matches, and they just didn't seem up to speed. That could be a concern again, but it does seem like maybe they've started to come into form just at the right time.
Yeah, it's always difficult to judge with state championship football because obviously a lot of it is, well, it's competitive, but in terms of the level of teams you're playing against, it is essentially semi-competitive, you know, at best.
Just don't mince your words. Tell the truth.
Yeah.
It is. Just,
well, I mean, it's a lot of the games are pretty useless, and it does kind of give you this kind of warped sense of how teams are actually getting on, if you take by their state championship results. But I think with last year, the problem last year was that the manager at the time, Marcelo Oliveira, was essentially Palmeiras had won the Brazilian Cup at the end of the previous year, and they won it essentially through like kind of individual skill and all that sort of thing. The team was really disorganized. The manager should have been sacked, but they kept him on until the start of the season. He did nothing with the team in the off season, and they were just useless at the start of the year. And he got booted just before the end of the group stage, and then Coca came in. So I think that there's a lot more preparation's been done. The team is a lot more experienced, actually. Like, as I've mentioned, a lot of players with big Libertadores pedigree have come in, and I don't think you're going to see the same kind of slow start that Palmeiras had last year. But it is just a case of whether the results are completely satisfactory to kind of get the critics off the manager's back, to be honest.
And a couple more questions. First of all, why did Cuca leave at the end of last season?
The full details of this have never really been made public, but it is understood that there's a health issue in his family. There's a member of his family who's kind of seriously ill, and he had promised that he was going to take 6 months out of the game to be with his family in Curitiba and not be a football manager. And so he made that promise to his family long before Brazil had won the Brazilian championship. And yeah, he kept his words. So he's taken the first semester of this year out. Might see him back in Brazil. Maybe if Eduardo Baptista gets sacked, he might be making a return to Palmeiras. Who knows? But yeah, that was why.
And I guess that your doubt about Felipe Melo is to do with his discipline, as he's quite an aggressive character, isn't he?
Well, yeah, there's that. But I think it's more of, there's a kind of combination of factors, and that kind of comes into it as well. I think personally, I don't think he is positionally aware enough to be the only defensive midfielder. I think he's often out of position. And I think that when he is struggling to get back into position, that's where he makes these massive fouls. And that's where he gets into trouble. And that's when he gets sent off. And that's when the fights start, all that sort of thing. And I just generally think he's got a lot of talent. He's really quite technically able. Some of the passes that he's been able to pull off are really quite impressive. But I just think that his kind of tactical discipline, I just don't think, you watch him for 90 minutes and he's rarely in the right place, you know, for most of those 90 minutes. He's not so aware in terms of where he has to be. I think that is perhaps a worry. And actually, Palmeiras, Eduardo Baptista, I think, has noticed this. And in the game on Friday night, he brought Zé Roberto back to play alongside Felipe Melo in defensive midfield. And that kind of helped out the kind of positioning and the protection of the back line a bit, which I think is probably the way forward, because I don't think you can really leave Felipe Melo in that spot just in front of the defence. I don't think he has the positioning skills to do it.
Well, listen, let's move across to Argentina and to Tucumán and Nico. Obviously, we saw them in the preliminary rounds of this tournament, and they go and they gave us a bit of a laugh, to be honest with you, with their almost Brazilian timekeeping. What are you expecting from them? They're not a team that I think none of us are that familiar with. And, you know, we saw their home legs whenever they played at home. Fantastic crowd, fantastic traditional Argentine atmosphere. What do you feel is they will bring to this group, Nico?
Atlético Tucumán are a very special team. They've never been the greatest protagonists in our league. In fact, they got promoted 2 years ago. But I think that after what happened a couple of weeks ago, they automatically earned the title of this year's underdogs. I mean, they could easily be named this year's Independiente del Valle. As I mentioned before, they are not a special team. They are the biggest team in the province in Tucumán. I should add that they are very well run by their president, and the fact that the 2016 tournament in Argentina was a short one. It was called a transition tournament, and it was meant to align our calendar to the European one. Of course, that ended up in nothing but well. So many teams saw that opportunity and make the most out of it. That is why today we are seeing strange Argentinian teams competing in the Libertadores, like Atlético Tucumán, Godoy Cruz, Lanús. I'm sure that many people watching the Cup, even if they are South American, haven't really heard about those teams before. Most of these teams are in the same situation. Atlético Tucumán, for example, well, they have a very good president. And in 2016, they were fifth in the transition tournament. They weren't technically qualified for the Copa Libertadores, but as we already know, after the Mexicans refused to participate in the Copa due to, schedule problems, an extra sport was offered to Argentina and the rest of the CONMEBOL teams. So that is where Atlético Tucumán comes in. Well, they've done a very good job so far. I think that they won't certainly win the group. I mean, it seems impossible, even though Palmeiras are not the greatest team in the world. They are the Brazilian champions, and that is a very meaningful credential. Peñarol, well, they are a giant of the continent. And Jorge Wisterman, they are, I believe, inside, but they're very difficult to play away. We already know that. Atlético Tucumán might bring a lot of special moments to this cup. I mean, they have already brought them, but speaking specifically about the group stages, they won't win the group. They might challenge for second place ahead of Peñarol, but that will depend on whether they win their home matches or not, because I don't think they have any chance away from home against Palmeiras or Peñarol. It's important to mention that they have changed their manager as well. Asconzabal, which was the man who originally got them into the Libertadores, left after a better proposal came from Huracán. So now Lavallén, their new manager, has maintained that base and brought some new talent into the team. For example, Sampedri, their number nine, came from a second tier team and has performed very well so far. Neri Leches, who is the number five, a short guy, blonde. He wore the number five jersey from our national team that day against El Nacional in Ecuador. So yeah, very very strong foundation, very good backbone. They also have very interesting and pacey wingers like Menendez, who's nicknamed the Polish because he's basically blonde. Everyone who's blonde in this country is nicknamed Polish.
Just a quick question, Nico. So for this first game at Tucumán against Palmeiras, like what are they looking for? Do they think they can come away with a win, or are they looking for a point, or are they expecting defeat? What's the kind of the view from the fans there?
Well, obviously the fan base is very excited after what they saw last week. I don't think they can come up with a win, but surely they will use the pressure of their fan base on their favor. Their front line is very good. and they practice a sort of very attacking football. So that might be dangerous for Palmeiras if they don't go there prepared.
Interesting, yeah.
Of course, it might not turn out to be that way. It could go the other way around with Palmeiras winning by a significant margin. But we'll have to see. It's very unpredictable at the moment due to the fact that Atlético Tucumán have been very good, but you never know. They're not a Boca or River. They're just a regular team living an adventure in some unprecedented and to completely new environment.
I think you might actually have a point with what you were saying about even at this stage. I mean, the group stages haven't even started yet, and you could already make a case for Tucumán being like the kind of the underdogs of the tournament. Because I mean, you often do get this in the Copa Libertadores. You have this teams for whatever reason pick up some sort of Libertadores mystique, which it makes it, obviously it encourages them and it can buoy them on to better results. But I think it also kind of intimidates opponents as well. When you come up against someone who everything seems to be going their way, the Libertadores is full of examples. I mean, when Atletico Mineiro when they won the Copa Libertadores, it just seemed like luck was constantly on their side. They were constantly coming up with late goals and penalties and all that sort of thing. And so there is that kind of element to this tournament, which I imagine if it's going to work in anyone's favour at the moment, it could be Atletico Tucumán because of what we saw in the qualifier.
Adam, I just want to bring you in at this point as well. The other two teams in the group, you're maybe a little bit more familiar with than the rest of us. And, you know, where do you think they fit? And obviously, Peñarol, we know from previous competitions, they'll probably put up a stiff challenge. But what way do you see this group going, Adam?
Peñarol are looking pretty strong, to be honest. They're Uruguayan champions. They claimed their 48th title in 2016. At that point, Diego Forlan was still playing for them. He's now left for India. But they have a very talented squad there. They have a couple of players I've seen a lot of in recent years, actually, in midfield. Thomas Costa is an ex-Universidad Católica player. He's a pretty handy midfielder. Guzman Pereira, it didn't really work out for him too well at Universidad de Chile, but he has made some appearances for Uruguayan national team, and he does seem more effective in Uruguayan football and for Peñarol. But they're looking pretty strong in midfield. Up front, there's a forward I like called Junior Arias. He's a handy forward. He will trouble defences with his movement. They also have Uruguayan international Zaboya Rodriguez. He has good pedigree and he will be very effective at this level. He offers some pace. He has an excellent shot on him as well. Good positioning sense. I think he will be one of the standout players in this group. Yeah, he's won titles in Spain and Portugal with Atletico Madrid and Porto. So he has, like I say, really good pedigree. Yeah, they have a neat team this year and I expect them to cause the teams in this group plenty of problems. Expect them to press the opposition, play with plenty of intensity and speed going forward. And from watching some of their highlights so far this season, they look like they're pretty handy in possession too. They can really keep the ball. Two other players possibly to look out for who played in the recent under-20 South American Championships, and that's the defender Santiago Bueno and the forward Diego Rossi. And they may also impress if given a chance. And as for the Bolivian side in this group, Jorge Wilstermann, they're from a city of Cochabamba. It has some altitude, nothing like La Paz, for example. They claimed their first title for 6 years at the start of 2016. And that's how they qualified for this tournament. They're one of the better supported clubs in Bolivia. They have a little bit of money behind them there. I actually recently brought back from China a Colombian striker called Luis Cabezas. He had quite a successful spell in China, apparently, and he could be a player to look out for in this group as well, a goal scorer.
And just quickly, just going back to Peñarol, they've got a midfielder who I'm a really big fan of, Nahitan Nández, the 21-year-old, who is really looking like he's going to have a really good year. And yeah, as you mentioned, like with Zaboya Rodriguez, I think they've got a really talented side. And something which is quite interesting about them is that their qualification for this came because of their performances at the end of 2015 and the start of 2016. But in the second half of last year, they basically just ignored the national championship. They finished, like, I believe I'm right in saying they finished 10th or something like that. Like, they basically didn't pay any attention.
Yeah, Nacional ran away with it, didn't they, at the end of the year?
Yeah. But with Peñarol, it was like you couldn't really work out exactly what was going on. Like, it wasn't just, it didn't seem like it was just they didn't need to win this tournament because they'd already got Libertadores qualification. It did seem like there was like something seriously wrong with the team, but I also believe I'm right in saying that their start this season has been really good. I don't think they've been beaten yet. And as you mentioned, Adam, they've got loads of really quite interesting players in there. So, I mean, if they can get that to kind of click, this could be quite a good year for them.
Just give me the two that you fancy for qualification. Obviously, Palmeiras. who else do you see going through with them?
I'd say Palmeiras and Peñarol, one and two.
And for Nico, same question. Who do you see coming out of this group?
Oh, I fancy Palmeiras getting the first spot. And second, it will be tough. It will be close between Peñarol and Atlético Tucumán. It will depend on whether Atlético Tucumán win their home games.
Indeed. And Adam, if I'm drawing you to two, who are you going for?
Yeah, I think I have to say Peñarol and Palmeiras. I think it could be quite an interesting battle for first out of those two, actually.
Indeed, it's hard to argue with that, actually. But listen, let's move into Group 6, where we find Atlético Mineiro, Libertad, Godoy Cruz, and Sport Boys. Again, I'll start with you, Ewan. Mineiro on this one, you know, again, you would sort of think that they would sort of be favourites, even though they've got Fredgy. They would be one of the favourites to get out of this one. How do you see it going for them?
Yeah, it looks to me like quite a favourable draw for them. I can't really see any of the other teams posing them that much of a that many problems, to be honest. Atlético Mineiro were an interesting one last year because they were one of the best teams in Brazil, like nominally best teams in Brazil. They made the final of the Brazilian Cup where they were beaten by Grêmio, and they were in the title race for a bit after eventually falling away. But the amazing thing about Atlético Mineiro last season was, when you actually watched them, was to see how really badly organized they were. And it was all on individual skill, which is what they have in spades. They were able to play Robinho, Fred, Lucas Prato, Romulo Otero, and Cazares, and Luan. They had so many excellent attacking options. And that's what really pushed them over the line last year. But they had a manager who did not seem to have any idea how to actually make the team play together. The massive spaces between the lines. It was like a kind of primary school style tactics, which was really quite amazing considering how far they went in the cup and in the league. But what they've got this year is they have Grêmio's old manager, Roger Machado, who is one of the most promising young managers in Brazilian football. He built a very attractive Grêmio side, playing a lot of good high-pressing football, a lot of passing possession, a lot of interesting triangles, and really quite pleasant to watch his style of football at Grêmio. And now he's at Atlético Mineiro. They have improved, I think. They've strengthened the squad, I would say. Lucas Prato, who was always really playing second fiddle to Fred as centre-forward, they didn't really need both of them. He's gone to São Paulo. But they've brought in Elias, formerly of Corinthians, Sporting Lisbon, and, of course, of the national side. You know, he's a proper quality player. He brings a lot of energy and intelligence into the midfield. Also, of course, in the manager, they have traded up about 10 tiers, I think, from the previous manager, Marcelo Oliveira. They've now got one of the most promising coaches in South American football, I think. And, yeah, I mean, it's maybe just taken them a little bit just to get going, to get to click at the moment. It's, you know, it's taking its time. But once they do, and I think they're probably going to be helped by the fact that the draw is quite favourable for them. Once they do get going, I think they are another candidate for the trophy, in my opinion.
Whoa, I don't know whether I'd agree with that or not. I think I may be a step too far for them. From the Argentinian side again, then, Nico, Godoy Cruz, where do you see them fitting into this group?
Godoy Cruz made a very good season back in 2016. They surprised everyone with their good quality of football. The reality is that as of today, they're running short on ideas simply because that 2016 season was like a once-in-a-lifetime thing. I mean, they are a club from Mendoza, which is not the most football-keen non-province. So that explains a lot. They have sold two of their best players from that season, Fernando Suki, who is now playing more appropriately like doing bench warming at Boca Juniors. And they've also sold Santiago Garcia, who was a very powerful striker that season for Godoy Cruz, scored lots of goals, scored a couple of brilliant free kicks as well. So those two players are gone, and now Godoy Cruz have a completely different formation. They've gone from a solid 4-4-2 to a 4-2-3-1 simply because they just don't have enough attacking power left to sustain that attacking football that they used to play. I don't know. I just simply don't see them going that far in this Copa Libertadores, especially without activity at a local level. I mean, the last couple of matches they played before the break, they lost them. They are 20th in our league, which in a regular league would mean last. I don't know. I just don't see them making it out of this group.
Would I be right in saying then that Godoy Cruz haven't played a competitive game since December?
Yeah, that's right. They haven't. I mean, they have played several amount of friendlies against second-tier teams and under 20 squads and that sort of thing, taking into consideration that Godoy Cruz are not a powerhouse. And if you add the fact that they are lacking proper football, proper physical activity at the highest level, yes, they might be into trouble.
Yeah, I would think so.
Okay, Doki. So, Adam, I'll come to you for the other two in the group and what you can tell us about them, Libertad and Sport Boy. And how do you see this one panning out then, Adam?
Yeah, I think you've got to make the Argentine and the Brazilian sides kind of a favourites to get out of this group. But you can't rule out Libertad. You know, they've been one of the stronger sides from Paraguay in recent years. Even if you just like look at their record on over kind of the last 15 years, they've qualified consistently for the Copa Libertadores, where before, say, 2000, they only qualified three times in their history. So this, I believe, is their 13th appearance since 2000. So they've got plenty of experience in their side as well, especially captain Javier Aquino. He's a Paraguayan international, and he's been at Libertad for like a decade now. Incredible servant for the club. He's had chances to move, but he's decided to stick with them. The only other thing I want to mention about Libertad for now, I think Nico has some information on them as well. This is one of my favourite kits in the Libertadores. They have like black and white stripes, and they always have Pulp as their sponsor, which is not the Britpop band from the 90s, but a soft drinks company in Paraguay, I believe. One to watch out for, kit lovers. Nico, do you have anything to add on Libertad?
I know what you're talking about. The Libertad kit is one of my favourites as well. That slick red logo is just so neat. It's just so simple. It's very satisfying to watch, sometimes even more than the team, to be honest. Libertad shouldn't be ruled out simply because they are Paraguayan. They know how to play these sort of competitions. Besides, they top the Paraguayan first division and they haven't lost in three games. That gives them like sort of the momentum. However, I wouldn't rule out Sport Boys just yet, and I'll tell you why. Sport Boys are currently managed by Xavier Azcargorta, who is obviously Basque from Spain, but he is a man who practically revolutionized Bolivian football. I don't know if you remember, but he was the manager who got Bolivar to the semi-finals back in 2014. Then they got demolished. They were demolished by San Lorenzo, but that did not reflect their performance at all. They were very good. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, definitely. Quite an interesting side, actually. they've qualified for this tournament by winning the Bolivian title at the end of 2015. It's a weird qualifying system in Bolivia. I've explained this before on pods. That means that they had to wait one whole year to finally play the group stages of Copa Libertadores. So there's been some changes from that championship winning squad. It is an experienced squad on paper. One signing they've made recently is an ex-Spanish international, believe it or not, from the glory era of Spanish football as well. And that's Jose Luis Capdevila. He's certainly one to look out for in this tournament this year. They also have Carlos Denario up front, who's an ex-Ecuador World Cup star, and he's quite an interesting forward. Danny Bejarano in midfield, he's a Bolivian international, 23 years old, quite dynamic. He's quite often paired with one of the stars of this Copa Libertadores so far, Alejandro Chumacero. Like Nico mentioned, maybe we can't rule them out completely, because they've got a very interesting manager there. But what I will say is that they look very weak in defence to me. Looking at their defensive record over the last sort of year or so in Bolivia, they've conceded a lot of goals. And I just feel, you know, the step up is probably going to be quite difficult for them to handle.
The other thing that you've got to remember about Sport Boys, not obviously that they always shine, is that they're from Santa Cruz de la Sierra, so they don't actually have any like altitude there, which is quite a novelty for Bolivian clubs, who can usually fall back on that. So I mean, teams going to play in Santa Cruz are not going to be suffering any adverse effects from the altitude, because it's essentially, I think it's like 500 meters above sea level or something like that. It's negligible.
Yeah, I'm sure they would never choose that way.
That's it. Sport Boys.
Okay, moving along into Group 7, we have Nacional, Chapecoense, Lanús and Zulia of Venezuela. So, Adam, I'm going to come to you on this one first. And we're going to talk about Nacional again, serial Copa Libertadores entrance. How do you see them going on this one?
Yeah, but they have a very talented squad. Well, much like Peñarol in that sense. One of the stars of the under 20 South American Championship, Rodrigo Amaral. He's very talented indeed. 19 years old. He also played in the under 20 championships when he was just 17 years old. And in both tournaments, he was a standout. He's like built a bit like Wayne Rooney, and has that kind of, you know, exciting energy that Rooney offered when he first broke through on the scene as well. So that's the player he's been compared to most. Much like Rooney, you probably have to watch his weight over the years as well, as he's quite a bulky fella. He's got a lot of talent. He's definitely one of the players I'm looking forward to seeing most in the Libertadores this year. They have decent players throughout the team. Alvaro Gonzalez in midfield offers plenty of experience. Brian Lozano is a standout as well. I think he could shine in this competition. Jorge Fuseli at the back. He's a Uruguayan international. Again, offers some stability and experience in defence. Kind of look through their team and you think, well, you know, they certainly offer quite a lot. They definitely have one of the better squads on paper, at least, going into this Libertadores. And they ended 2016 really strong, as you mentioned earlier, with them winning the title by miles. I think we could really see a run from them this year after them being slightly disappointing in recent years.
No, indeed. And before I come to Chapecoense with Ewan, because I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about them. Nico, for you, Lanús, another one that I'm not really that familiar with in Argentina. What's your thoughts on them? What do we expect from them?
Lanús should be a very interesting side, mostly because they have established themselves as a very stable institution, which has allowed them to win many titles over the last couple of years. Back in 2007, they won the local tournament. They went into a Libertadores and they were last in their group. So that was very disappointing. Sort of a second chance for them after winning the Transition Championship in 2016. They beat San Lorenzo in the final 4-0. It was a very strong side, which also featured Miguel Almirón and Junior Benitez, two pacey, very skillful wingers that were recently sold to Atlanta United and Boca Juniors respectively. So they have lost many important players, but they still hang on. They're very good. They recently beat River Plate in for the Super Cup 3-0. That was a very convincing win. After that, they bought Germán Denis, very popular Argentinian striker, who started in Independiente, then moved to Atalanta, and then came back. So he could be a very good alternative for José San, their historical goal-scoring machine. Lots of quality in this side, and I wouldn't say that is an accessible group, but let's be realistic. Zulia won't be that much of a challenge for the Uruguayan champions and the Argentinian champions. And Chapecoense, even though they were demonstrating a very good level of football institutional structure before the tragedy, I think they are still moved by what happened, and I don't see them beating this very powerful Lanús side.
I've seen quite a bit of Lanús over the last year. I know that they have lost a couple of the key players, as you mentioned, but they are a very good team from 1 to 11. There's no massive standouts there, but anymore anyway. Certainly, Almarin certainly was one. But like you say, he's moved on to Atalanta United. For me, I think they could be a bit of a dark horse this year from what I've seen of them. Anyway, they were very impressive in that 3-0 victory, especially in the second half over River in the Argentine Super Cup.
Yeah, well, like you say, they could be a dark horse, especially because they have now, they have in recent years switched the manager. Barros Esqueloto left and certainly left a very good legacy behind him, a very solid 4-3-3 formation with very good players and a very strong middle of the park with Roman Martinez, Ivan Marcone. Now that, for example, now that Miguel Almirón left, Nicolás Aguirre has a lot more opportunities to display his football. He might not be that attacking, but he's a very technical player, so that might come in handy for Lanús, especially in this edition of the Copa Libertadores, where they will be facing very important rivals who know how to play these kind of games. So I think that they will need patience and experience much more than pace and explosion.
And a quick word on José San, who's kind of a legend of Lanús, no?
Well, he won the title back in 2007. He scored lots of goals, then moved to, I think it was Saudi Arabia. So, well, he obviously made lots of money. Then he came back and amazingly at the age of 34, or I think it was 35, he was like the top scorer of the tournament and he won the championship again. It was amazing. He scored every penalty and he still has the touch and knows how to use his body. So he's a complete forward and someone who I'm really looking forward to seeing in the Copa Libertadores.
Yeah, it's just an interesting one for me because it looked like his career was petering out. You know, he was moved around various Argentine clubs, nearly all of them kind of smaller than Lanús as well. And then suddenly he turned up at Lanús at the start of 2016 and started banging the goals in again. It was incredible. It's funny how some players have that special connection to a club and can turn it on.
Yeah, that was certainly amazing. That is why I think that this Lanús side, even though they have sold their best stars, they still have the touch and they play much more like a team, like you mentioned before. There are 11 players on the pitch and there are no standouts, no players who are more important than others. That is very important.
Well, listen, I want to bring it across to Ewan and Chapeco because we really don't know. I've seen them a couple of times in the state leagues, Ewan. They've looked okay, but this is another level. And I think this is where, you know, we're really going to find out what this, you know, this team that have, you know, basically been thrown together in the wake of this tragedy. And they're going to face some sort of stiff tests in this group. What do you feel is a realistic expectation for them, Ewan?
Well, like, first of all, I think that this group is, although, I mean, there's a couple of other contenders for perhaps more interesting groups, but I'm going to be paying a lot of attention to this one because, I mean, as we've been talking about Lanús and Nacional, very capable teams, And I'm also, I'm really interested to see what Zolia can come up with, because I don't follow that much Venezuelan football, but they seem to have a lot of money behind them, and Juan Arango's there, and they're coached by Cesar Farias, and it looks, they look like they actually could do something. And then, of course, you've got Chapecoense, who, after the tragedy at the end of last year, as you say, have essentially just had to put a brand new squad together over the space of a couple of months. And it's, yeah, obviously it's difficult to tell exactly how this is going to go for them, because they've brought in about over 20 new players, most of them on loan. But the level of the players they've brought in for Chapecoense as a club, they've brought in some fairly middling talent in terms of like Brazilian top division. So in terms of quality, I'm not sure they've lost that much quality. I think what they've lost is the fact that they don't have that team spirit anymore. I mean, a lot of these players have only been playing together for just a few weeks, really, so they don't really have that sort of bond that obviously the last year's team did. Something that might work in their favour is that they have probably, in 2017, they've probably played the most games already, the most competitive games already out of any of the teams in Libertadores. I think they're on their 12th competitive game of 2017, which, when you compare it to Godoy Cruz, for example, we talked about, they haven't played since December, you know. So Chapecoense are getting a bit of match rhythm, you know, they're certainly match fit. It's difficult because obviously there's so many question marks about this brand new team who have just been put together over a short space of time. But of course, it's just going to be, I think in a lot of these games, it's just going to be a really quite an emotional occasion. I mean, their first game is going to be away against Zulia in Maracaibo. And so that's going to be a long journey and obviously very emotional one. And to see them take the pitch and play that match in the Copa Libertadores for the first time in their history, it's really going to be quite powerful, I think. And that is something which, in terms of the results, they could, if they play their cards right, they could use that into their favour in terms of having the players and the fans motivated. But yeah, I think it's going to be difficult for them. I wouldn't expect any miracles, but I think they've got themselves to a level where they can compete. And I'm not sure if they can qualify, but I think they can compete. I think in general, this whole group, I would say that Lanús are probably above the other three in terms of quality and capability. But I think that this is going to be a really quite an interesting and competitive group. And I really don't know what way it's going to go.
Ian, would you not feel, I have a sneaking suspicion that, you know, you said it's going to be an emotional occasion and so on, and these group of players, you know, have basically been thrown together. Like, there's no getting around it. But in times like that, that could be the bonding exercises. That could be the glue that brings this group together, and they could maybe throw a few surprises at us.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I say, they're working from a base in terms of like a quality base, which is not that, you know, it's not that not that much more inferior. No, that's not right. It's you know, it's not that different from the Chapecoense team of last year, who obviously had a good few talented players, but this Chapecoense team have already managed to bring in some players who have quite a lot of experience in not just Brazilian football, but also South American football. You have Wellington Paulista, for example, who he has had several seasons playing Libertadores with Cruzeiro. And so he knows what he's getting himself into. He knows how to play against Argentinian clubs, Uruguayan clubs, all that sort of thing. So he has that experience there. And it could be the emotion, they could definitely use that to work in their favour and to really put up quite a good challenge in this group. I'm not convinced whether they're going to qualify, but as I say, I think it is going to be competitive and probably go right down to the last match day. But yeah, it's definitely going to be a group that I'm going to keep a close eye on.
Chapecoense do have the element of surprise, because honestly, no one has seen them play that much, or no one knows their squad that much. We already know that the element of surprise should not be underestimated, especially in this cup. This could be a very good opportunity for them.
Adam, I believe now we'll move on to Zulia, who you actually recorded another little insert for us. Do you want to introduce that?
Yeah, I did. I spoke to Nick Carter earlier, not the guy who used to be in Backstreet Boys, but a guy in England who follows Venezuelan football. And he was kind enough to join us on the show and give us his thoughts on Zulia. Nick, how are you, first of all?
Hi, Adam. Yeah, very well. Thank you for having me. It feels a bit of a stretch to call me an expert, but that's very kind of you. Thank you.
Zulia, first of all, how did they qualify?
So Zulia qualified for Copa Libertadores by virtue of coming runners-up in the grand final of the 2016 season. So much like the rest of South America, Venezuela divides its seasons into two short tournaments. They won the Clausura, beating Táchira in the final, and then they lost to Zamora, who are the other team in the Copa Libertadores this year, in the grand final. So essentially, you can call them sort of runners-up for Venezuela that year. They're a relatively newish club. Football's been in Maracaibo, the city in which they're based, for a long while. But Zulia, as the main club in the city, is very, very recent, probably the sort of past 5-10 years. Up until about 2 years ago, they were in kind of disarray, not very well run, but they've since been taken over by Cesar Farias, who's the former Venezuelan national team manager, who's now with the Strongest in Bolivia, and he's now the president of the club, and he's instilled quite a degree of order, you know, sort of good practice to the club, which we're seeing a lot more over Venezuela. So hopefully over the next few years we'll see, you know, a few more clubs pick up their organization.
Interesting. Yeah. It'd certainly be amazing if Zulia got out of the group and met the Strongest in the next round.
It would be. There would be quite a conflict of interest.
Yeah,
the Zulia are managed by Danny Farias, who is Cesar's brother. And last year, actually, they were managed by a chap by the name of Cesar Marcano, who is actually now Cesar's assistant at the Strongest. Him and Danny switched places in the winter, which I feel is a little bit harsh on Marcano because he did an excellent job for them.
Excellent, excellent. How can we expect Zulia to set up?
They'll probably set up in a sort of 4-2-3-1 formation. You know, the most attention is going to be on their attacking trio. They've almost got sort of three generations of Venezuelan attacking midfielders sitting behind the lone front man. So they've got obviously Juan Arango, who everyone will know as Venezuela's greatest football export.
Yeah,
definitely. He's returned home at 36 to pull the strings. And then on the left, they'll have Johandri Orozco, who you may remember from brief spells in Wolfsburg. He came through one of the under-20 sides in, I think, 2011, maybe? And he's been recently with the New York Cosmos, but he's come back there. And then on the right wing, you've got a young chap by the name of Jefferson Savarino, who is pretty much the big young talent in Venezuela at the moment. He had a fantastic 2016. He was the top scorer, and he pretty much carried them mostly on his own, but not completely, to the title. And he sort of dragged them a long way. So he's a very interesting player as well. So, I expect a sort of 4-2-3-1. Danny Farias is a man who likes kind of more of a passing game. So hopefully we'll see more of a kind of possession-centered game. He's a little bit more expansive than his predecessor, Marcano. And they've kind of started 2017 in sort of in different form. The first game, they really didn't look very coherent, but they have started to pull it together a bit more. The thing I worry about them is I think their defense is very weak. There's no pace there at all. Absolutely no pace. They don't really have a proper right back either. So I think anyone that gets at them, they're going to get a lot of goals against them.
Okay, they actually open up their Copa Libertadores campaign with what will sure be quite an emotional occasion, because of course they've got Chapecoense in their first
indeed
game.
Yeah,
how do you think, you know, that will pan out? Obviously, has there been sort of any mention in the Zulia camp about the tragedy and how they're going to handle the occasion?
I will be honest, I haven't really seen much said about it. Information is not always doesn't always transfer that far. So I honestly haven't seen them make too much reference about the kind of tragedy for Chapecoense. I think there'll obviously be a lot of curiosity because no one is really fully sure what to expect from Xhaka Kouyaté, obviously, because they've done an amazing job to rebuild. They've put together an entirely new squad and everything in very short circumstances. So I think they'll have done very well to do that. But I think there's a degree of uncertainty. No one really knows what Xhaka Kouyaté will bring to the table. And I guess also to the same degree, no one really knows what Zulia will bring to the table. This is sort of their debut. So I think there will just be a lot of sort of, surprise almost at everything that happens, really. I'm hoping it'll be a great occasion.
Yeah, I think it'll be quite a well-watched match, obviously, with all the intrigue around Xhaka Kouyaté at the moment.
I think they've sort of become everyone's second team, haven't they?
Sure.
So, Adam, putting you on the spot, I'm going to ask you for two teams to come out of this group. Who do you think it will be?
Nacional and Lanús.
And Nico, for you, do you have anything different?
Oh, I think it will be Nacional and Lanús. I think that Lanús will top the group, though, and Xhaka Kouyaté will claim the third spot.
And Ewan, any hope for Xhaka?
I really think that the second place, as I agree with Nico saying that Lanús are probably going to top the group, but I think that this second place is going to be one of the closest in this whole group stage. I'm going to go for Xhaka Kouyaté.
Good man. As you rightly said, it's one of the ones I'm going to be behind Xhaka Kouyaté the whole way. It's just after what's happened and so on. It's our first, it's the first time in a little bit of Doris and so on. It's just something to get behind. And I'm not a great admirer of Brazilian football, but I'll certainly be behind them all the way. But listen, let's move on into the final group in Group 8. And there we have another Brazilian side in the form of Grêmio. We have Guarani, who, if Austin Miller was here, would be telling us about penalty shootouts. We have Zamora, and as well, Adam's going to put his clown outfit on because we have a Chilean side in here who are letting them down at every turn in the form of a Kike. I think I've pronounced that correctly. So, Adam, I'll come to you first, because I haven't come to you first with the whole pod. Talk me through a Kike.
Well, a Kike are a team based in northern Chile. They're actually the rivals of my team here in Chile, Arica, so I don't have too much love for them. But they've had their best ever year in the last 12 months. They almost won the title last year. They kind of blew it in the final straight, especially in a home game against Universidad Católica, where they ended up losing 6-2 at home. That was kind of the final nail in their title challenge, really, and Católica went on to win it. The big problem facing Iquique in this group, I'd be confident that they could sneak second place in this group if they had proper home matches, but they don't. At the moment, they are rebuilding their stadium, and although they play their league games in this tiny little stadium by the beach in Iquique, they aren't permitted to use that stadium in the Libertadores. So they will be playing their games at the home of Cobreloa, and Cobreloa based in Calama, quite a few hours away. You're talking somewhere between sort of 6 to 8 hours from Iquique, I believe, by road, that is, and sort of an hour by car, hour by plane. So, it's not the most accessible of home matches for their fans and players. So they've lost that advantage straight away. From their squad, they do have some interesting talents. None that will, match some of the talents that I've mentioned already in this show. But for example, up front, they have Alvaro Ramos, who's in really great goal scoring form over the last few months. He's already netted a hat trick this season as well. In midfield, they have Mesia de Villa, who has made a couple of appearances for kind of the Chile B national team. He's quite talented on his day. The Argentine Gonzalo Bustamante, he can cause some problems. He's quite a dynamic midfielder. So they've got some talent there. I think that the problem for them, like I say, is the fact that, they've lost home advantage, basically. And I think in the Libertadores, that's pretty fatal.
And yourself, Ewan, for Grêmio. Now, Grêmio, as I see them, are always a good cup team. And along with Palmeiras, I see them maybe as one of the stronger challengers from Brazil. Would you agree with me on that?
Perhaps. at some point last season, I would have agreed with you on that. And because Grêmio are the current Brazilian Cup champions, as you say, yeah, they're a good cup team. They've always had that sort of that knockout pedigree, which has always seemed to work in their favour. It's their kind of their style of play is typically suited to that kind of football. But basically, what happened last season is earlier on in the podcast, I mentioned Roger Machado, who is now the manager of Atlético Mineiro. So he was previously the manager of Grêmio, but he eventually, some way through the season last year, he felt that he could get no more out of the team and he stepped down. And the man who replaced him at Grêmio is Renato Gaúcho, who is a fan's favourite idol, hero. I mean, he is the man for Grêmio fans, because as a player, he took them to the Copa Libertadores, to the Intercontinental Cup titles as well, and played for Brazil. So he is really the fans' favourite there. So he obviously has a lot of credit with the fans. But my issue with him is that he's more of a motivator than anything else. He inherited Grêmio side with excellent tactical foundations laid down by Roger Machado. They built this really attractive style of play, and Renato Gaúcho was able just to come in and not change anything and just get the players motivated and took them on to the Brazilian Cup win. But obviously, without that kind of reinforcement from someone like Roger Machado, these kind of impressive tactical foundations, they need to be reinforced. You know, if they're going to be able to keep playing in that style, they need to be reinforced. And Renato Gaúcho is not the person to do that. So I'm wondering if we're going to see, perhaps some way through the middle of the year, Grêmio really dropping off in terms of the quality of their play and the attractiveness of their play. And there's a few other reasons why that might happen, namely because they have sold their defensive midfielder Wallace, who he won Olympic gold with Brazil in the Rio Olympics, and he's gone to Hamburg in Germany. He was just a really, really excellent defensive midfielder, really important to the whole rhythm of that Grêmio team. Very good passer, very good at picking the ball up, pivoting, seeing passes, disguising his passes, keeping the ball moving. An absolutely integral part to that Grêmio team. And now that he's gone, he's not going to be replaced by anyone with anywhere near the same technical capabilities as he has. So obviously the team losing quality without Wallace. And you've also got their mid-30s playmaker Douglas, who is... Renato Gaúcho basically tried to build the team around Douglas, because he's this really old style playmaker in Brazilian football. You know, he's getting on a bit. He's got a bit of a grey beard, and he's a little bit overweight. He likes a pint, all that sort of stuff. So the fans love him, but he has suffered quite a serious injury, which is going to keep him out for most of this Copa Libertadores campaign. And once again, there's no one of that particular style to come in and play Douglas's position. So I think with all of that coming together, and the fact that this attractive Grêmio that we knew and loved last year and in 2015, the fact that that is probably not long for this world, that that's probably not going to continue for that long, I think that I'm not looking at Grêmio as Libertadores contenders. I think they're going to get out of the group. But when the time comes to come up against some really top-level opposition, I think they might end up struggling.
Interesting. And, Nico, do you know anything about Guarani from Paraguay?
Well, Guarani will not be the same team that they were in 2015 when they came up against River Plate in the semi-final of the Copa. The main reason is that back then they had their main striker, Santander, who plays for Copenhagen today. Yeah, he's a very, very big guy. He knows how to do like the pivoting role. A very good striker overall, so they will miss him. That is far beyond from my views. I don't think that Guarani have much more to offer apart from their home advantage. Maybe some very, very impressive young forces. I really don't know much about them because their 2015 campaign was something very unique. Things have changed a lot from since then.
And Adam, what any expectations from yourself on Guarani? Obviously, they went deep, as Nico obviously said there from 2015. And you know, Austin's favourite moment of last year when they went out to Independiente, bloody hell, IDV. any thoughts?
Arguably the side I know least about, actually, going into this Copa Libertadores. So I'm keen to see them in action against Iquique soon enough. Looking at their team on paper, you know, it looks like a mix of youth and experience. They've got a couple of Uruguayans there in midfield. Marcelo Balao, for example, he's been around for years, played in this competition a few times before. I think the second spot in this group is quite open. And again, I spoke to Nick earlier about Zamora's chances in this group. What do you make of Zamora's chances in the Copa Libertadores this year?
I think if possible, maybe even worse, maybe not as well as even Zulia's, which is quite a surprise. Zamora have, over the past sort of 3-4 years, turned into the most dominant club in Venezuela, which, you know, is massive when you consider they've overturned, you know, traditionally big clubs like Caracas and Táchira. The work started with Noel San Vicente, who had a terrible run as the Venezuelan national team manager. They're currently led by a chap called Francesco Stefano, who plays football in a very similar way. He likes a good attacking team, a nice press on the opposition, stretching them wide and attacking them with pace down the flanks. But they've kind of been so successful over the past few years that they've lost a lot of players. So players like Gabriel Torres, Jordan Osorio, and someone that Simon will hopefully know quite soon, a defender called Edwin Peraza, have all left in you know, recent years. So actually this kind of Zamora team that they've got this year is very different to the one they had last year and the one they had the year before. So each year they tend to lose one or two, you know, really key players. And you always look at them and wonder, how are they going to do this year? And for some reason, for some unknown way, they managed to pull something out of the bag and be up there again at the end. I think possibly this year might be one step too far. From last year's team, the big loss is obviously Jefferson Soteldo, who's joined Chilean football in Huachipato. But they've also lost Pedro Ramirez, who was the other attacking midfielder, who was really the brains behind the unit. They've lost both centre-backs, as I said, in Osorio and Peraza. And so they've sought to bring in some decent replacements. So they brought in Juan Falcon, who's returned from Colombia to play up front. But he's out at the moment with a kind of a mystery back injury. And no one's really sure what's going to happen to him. One of the centre-backs they brought in was a Uruguayan called Ignacio Gonzalez, who's fairly experienced. He's played a bit in Bolivia. I think he's played in Chile as well. And he's just torn his knee ligaments and will be out for 8 months. So I think things are looking a little bit ropey for them, if I'm honest. They have got a good team, but I think the spine will be quite weak. Their two central midfielders are excellent in Luis Melo and Luis Vargas. So that's the real strength of the team, is they've got an excellent central pairing. Much like Zulia, they'll line up, I think, in a 4-2-3-1. But a lot of the unknown is going to be the rest of the pitch. I mean, they've got a decent keeper, good fullbacks, excellent central midfielders. But beyond that, it's a very green team. Stefano's playing a lot of young kids, which is to be applauded. But I think they will struggle with the pressure of the Libertadores.
Yeah, well, they do appear to be in quite a kind group. I think most people sort of see Group A as possibly the weakest group of the eight, with Gremio kind of a standout team. But that kind of second spot looks quite open. And I think they stand a chance of sneaking through in second, personally. But those three sides, as on paper at least, you know, fairly equally matched. But you know, Libertadores isn't like the Champions League. It's these teams are far more unpredictable. So you're never quite sure what you're going to get.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, a couple of years back, they did a. I remember them. I think they were in the group with Gremio then. they didn't make it through, but they looked like they, you know, would have a shot with it. So, it, like you say, you can't ever tell. I mean, the opener is obviously against Gremio, so you'd be hoping for, you know, you love a good performance early doors, but I think they'll go down to Gremio. And then it depends on how they can pull it back really from then on.
They start home to Gremio. So
yeah, it is at home, I think.
Yeah.
But even at home, I don't expect them to turn Gremio over.
No. All right. Okay. That was going to be my next question. If you feel that if they had a chance of maybe getting something, because, you know, Venezuela, you know, isn't an easy place to go. You know, I don't think many teams fancy it, as cliched as that is.
Well, I mean, I say I don't think they'll turn Gremio over, but then I didn't think we'd have two wins in the Sudamericana this week. So I'm open to being wrong on this.
Venezuelan club football certainly looks in better shape than, say, Chile and Peru, judging by results in the last sort of 2-3 years or so. I definitely don't think you can rule Zamora out. Anyway, Nick, thanks for joining us.
No problems.
On this show. You're welcome back anytime in the future.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and thanks to Nick Carter again for those little bits of information. Again, he's not from the Backstreet Boys or Duran Duran or Take That, so there you go. But it's just one question before we close for Nico, and it's one that Adam actually brought up on the first preview podcast, and that's how you will feel about Argentinian sides with their lack of football and how that might affect their Libertadores campaigns.
Well, I think it will be very tough for them. We've already mentioned that. This edition will not see the most talented Argentinian side ever. So if you add that to the fact that they haven't competed in months, that could be a major drawback for the Argentine contenders this year. I don't see them winning the Libertadores. Maybe River or Estudiantes could have a slight chance. But even the better sides, they are not fit. They haven't practiced. They're not competing professionally. So it will be very hard for a country this year to make a good impression.
Just a quick point on that. I think both the Brazilian and Argentine sides might be helped by the fact that you've got an extended format this year. So it gives sides more time to grow into the tournament, which is probably going to suit, you know, both sides more because, you know, you've just got the state leagues at the moment in Brazil. There's been this big delay for the Argentine league as well. So, you know, there's only a couple of games in March instead of sort of the usual 3 or 4 that you get in sort of the first 6 weeks of the Libertadores. Yeah, I think the extended format will help a lot. And the last two Argentine teams who won it, San Lorenzo and River Plate, they got off to terrible starts anyway, you know, but they really struggled to get through their group. And then they went on and won it in the end. So I don't think we can read too much into maybe if the Argentine teams did struggle in this opening couple of weeks of the Libertadores. I think we need to let them grow into the tournament.
That's the magic of the Copa Libertadores, isn't it? I think that the extended format, it might be beneficial, but it will depend on whether the teams can maintain the main stars throughout the whole year. Because if they cannot hold on to their most important players, it will be the same than nothing, the same as nothing.
This extended format is, I mean, in general, I'm in favor of it. But what I think is going to be really quite interesting, or perhaps quite detrimental to the knockout stages, is the way that these matches have been scheduled is quite strange. Because you've got, for example, in the last 16, there is a month between the first and second legs. And then there's going to be another month until the quarterfinals. And then another month until the semifinals. And then 3 weeks before the final. So it's there's this space which we've never really seen in the Copa Libertadores. It's usually this kind of mad rush where the team that builds the most momentum, as we've seen in the past few years, I mean, momentum in the knockout stages of the Libertadores is absolutely crucial. But maybe this year it's not going to be that, because there's going to be huge gaps between not only the stages, but especially in the example of the round of 16, there is going to be over a month in between the first legs and the second legs, which I think is just going to be quite bizarre.
Yeah, and a lot can happen in that month.
That touches kind of on my point where I think that will probably favour the Brazilian-Argentine sides, because what you've got there is, you know, bigger squads, bigger resources, kind of bigger sides in general, I think it favours. Maybe just not from those two countries, but it's more likely that you'll see, I think, bigger sides go further this year than maybe we have done it in more recent years, where we've had a few surprises, certainly getting to the semi-finals, or like last year, even the final with Independiente de Valle. I think that's less likely this time around, but I hope to be proved wrong.
Well, listen, Adam, you had the same thing last night, and you picked your potential winner and your dark horse. So I'll give Nico and Ewan a chance here at the same. Nico, obviously it's very difficult with a couple of doors, but today as it stands, if I had to pick, you know, I'd make you pick a winner and a dark horse, well, you know, a team that might surprise us, who do you think those two teams would be?
Atletico de Madrid. No, just kidding. Well, I think that this Copa will be very different because we have more teams and that means more possibilities. Of course, Atletico Nacional are my first choice because, obviously they are one of the best sides in the continent and in the world as well. Regarding the dark horse, I don't know, I'm very undecided between the strongest Lanús and River Plate, because River Plate, I might hate them, but they're always, they know how to play this kind of competition.
Can River Plate really be considered a dark horse?
Last year's performance.
Oh, true. I think it's always difficult, actually. Yeah, I know that I said like Lanús is kind of a dark horse, but you know, they are the Argentine champion, so it's probably not fair to call them a dark horse, really. I think it's a bit different from the Champions League, where you get the same names every year crop up. You know, the Libertadores always produces sort of a new name each year that can challenge. So, yeah, it's going to be fun and interesting. Ewan, your thoughts?
Well, Palmeiras are going to win the Copa Libertadores. If they don't win the Copa Libertadores, I'm looking at... could you call Estudiantes a dark horse? I think they've got a pretty decent side this year. As Nico mentioned, I think the strongest are going to do quite well. I fancy them actually to get out that group. And also, I've been impressed by, certainly from what I saw last season, of Barcelona from Guayaquil. If they can make it out of that difficult group one, then they could pick up some momentum in that knockout stage. But Palmeiras are going to win, so it's irrelevant.
Well, put it like this, Ewan. I'll go on record here. If a Brazilian side wins this year's Copa Libertadores, I'll donate 50 quid to a charity of your choice. There you go.
Palmeiras or Atlético Mineiro, I think.
Well, I really want to see back-to-back wins for Atlético Nacional, and failing that, of course, the strongest.
The problem with Atlético Nacional is Palmeiras have all of their best players.
Ah, but from what Simon was saying last night, that they seem to have done very well and they're very well structured. And I just hope that they're the same team and the same style and the same spirit of football that we saw last season. I just don't think a Brazilian team will win it. I would love to see the strongest win it as my dark horse, just for the crack. You know, they do provide us with entertainment, but this year they're providing us with entertainment on the football field as well. They've been very impressive in the preliminaries. Obviously, it's not the group stages. We'll see how they go there. But they've always got that home advantage. But listen, guys, thank you all very much for your time, as always. It's been a fascinating listen to you. And before we go, I'll just run around the table. I'll start with Nico first. Where can we find you on Twitter? Where can we find your work? And anything else you'd like to promote, fire away.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at @Miremont_Nico. I tweet about all sorts of things, not just football, general knowledge, culture. I also write quite regularly for Futebol Cidade, and you can find me there. I like to write about the more abstract side of football, not just transfers and that sort of thing. That is my work, and I hope you enjoy it. Give it a try, and don't be misled by my podcast abilities. I like to do what I do, but this is very new to me.
Well, listen, we'll tell you, you're sitting here with three expats who work in a second language, so there's absolutely no problem. You're doing fantastically. And hopefully you'll come back again through the course of the competition and talk to us, and we haven't traumatized you too much with this.
No, it's been very fun, so I'll be glad to join you on another occasion, of course.
Well, you're very welcome. And you and yourself, thank you again so much for coming on. Where can we find you? What are you working on at the minute? Far away.
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at Ewan Marshall. That's E-U-A-N. Yeah, so anything I do, I'll post on there. What am I working on? Oh, right. So I've been... Last season, I was doing a kind of a video series on Brazilian football. I call it Gazeta Brasil, which was quite fun. We essentially did it as like a bit of an experiment. But we're planning to get back into that this year. And so hopefully in the next few weeks, you will see a video or two, and that will continue throughout 2017. But yeah, just follow me on Twitter and anything I post will go on there.
Sounds like a cool idea. I'll be giving that a look. And last but certainly not least, yourself, Mr. Brandon, where can we find you? What are you working on? Plug away.
Yeah, you can find me at Kanija Scores. I feel like I've spent a lot of time on podcasts over the last week, often to the early hours of the morning.
Welcome to my world.
Obviously, we did the Germany 2006 World Cup pod at the start of this week, and a lot of people have got back to me saying they've really enjoyed listening to our memories of that tournament. So give that a listen. We also recorded the first edition of the new style South American football show, where we look at kind of more issues kind of off the field rather than on. There we spoke to Christian from LAFA, and he told us about how Latin American footballers settle in the UK. So that's quite an interesting listen. And obviously I hosted the groups 1-4 Copa Libertadores preview last night, and that's already out. So obviously if you're listening to this, I'm sure you've already listened to that, so I don't know why I'm plugging it. But in case you haven't, go back and listen to that. I recorded that with Austin and Simon, who were excellent as ever.
Oh, well, you know what you say, Brandon. You know, like, you've got a trumpet blowout. From my own side of things, there's just all the pods. And I couldn't tell you what's out in WFI. I edited them all, but I was half drunk at the time. It was Carnival. My apologies. Just listen to them all. Anything we do, we'll be back. Normal service resumes next week, so all the pods will be back up to their usual standards. As I say, it was just a rough week. Once a year I have to go away. So listen, just one last thanks to the guys for their time. Brilliant guests, great podcast, and thanks to the listener, and until the next one, it's goodbye.